To set the scene a little bit about our book, which is Mercy, Lara's first novel, I've read it, my wife's read it, we think it's an excellent novel, you guys should read it, it's really great. Mercy concerns a time and a place really far in the imagination from where we are tonight. It concerns Kenya and East Africa and Africa in the middle of the 90s. A time in East Africa of a lot of political turbulence, wars going on in various different parts of the continent, partly spillover from the genocide in Rwanda, which we've all heard about. That in itself triggered war and instability in various places. It was a time when I was working as a journalist, covering those wars, and what would happen is the foreign correspondents would be based in Nairobi, which was a great place to live, and we'd fly off to parts of Zaire or Rwanda or Burundi, and we'd cover these wars, and then we'd come back and take a breather in Nairobi, and then we'd go back out again. And it was just generally a very, very intense period of time, a very intense few years. A lot of adrenaline, a lot of excitement, a lot of danger. A lot of learning, really, about a continent where the doesn't matter how much time you spend there, at the end of that time you still feel as though you've only just scratched the surface. So a great place and a great time to be there. Lara's book is, in a sense, a record, or partly it's a record of what it was like at that time for foreign journalists and the kind of people who did work there at that time. But just to tell you about the first time that I came into contact with Lara, I was sitting in my office in Nairobi, and the phone rang, and I was told that it was for me, and I picked up the phone, and somebody said, well, you've never met me, and you've never heard of me. I'm at the airport in Nairobi. I've just arrived from Italy. I've come here to work as a foreign journalist. I don't know anybody. You know, my name is Lara Santoro, and I was given your phone number, and I hope that we could maybe meet. Well, needless to say, Lara and I did meet. We became good friends, and Lara went on to be a really excellent journalist. She worked a great deal in places like Zaire during the war. She worked all across Africa. She did some significant reporting in Nigeria, in the Delta. She spent time in Yugoslavia, particularly in Belgrade, during the Kosovo conflict. She worked for the Christian Science Monitor, she worked for Newsweek, and she became a very distinguished journalist in her own right, as well as being a good friend. So that is why it is such a pleasure for me to be able to introduce tonight her and her novel, Mercy. What I'm hoping that we can do, if Lara will agree, is to speak to us and to read from the book. And at the end, perhaps, to have a time when we can take questions. Because I'm sure that people will have questions for her, both about the book and about the time that she spent in Africa. So, without any further delay, I would like to introduce our special guest for this evening, Lara Santoro.
Thank you very much for coming. I thought I might just read from the book first and then tell you a bit about it, and then maybe we could just open the floor to a nice discussion. Show me a play, and tell me if I'm yelling, because... Show me a place as full of God as this. Show me land gathered at the seams by thorns as thick. Show me rivers as full of light, of tumult. Show me life as cheap, song as full. Mimi Nawewe, Mercy sang in the kitchen, her vast behind keeping stroke. Why the journalists they come to Africa, she asks, to see the people dying. Don't be ridiculous, I mutter, flicking through the daily paper, mentally adding up the dead. We don't do massacres, my editor warned, but what else was there to do? I became a chronicler of pain, the dead stacking up in the mortuary of my mind, unburied. Give us the ray of light in the dark, my editor said, but there was no light to speak of. The longer I stayed, the angrier I became, until, with the mute coherence of all seismic events, Africa unshackled itself from my perception and brought me proof of light beyond light. You'll find out the hard way, people who lived in Africa told me when they heard of my assignment. The truth is that for the first couple of years, Africa did not trouble me at all. I spent entire afternoons poring over my Michelin maps, studying the arbitrariness of boundaries, the locations of airstrips, the steady course of roads marked in solid red, the tentative meandering of those in somber blue. I traveled without pause. The heat, the mud, the racket, the box of bones waiting for me at the end of every story, none of it bothered me. Then one evening in Nairobi, the monsoon rains came pounding down, and a million ant flies gathered at my doors and windows, desperate for entry. In the morning, the ground outside was thick with insect stumps, gossamer tissue. It was a holocaust, and for the first time I remember thinking, this is how they die. This is how the Africans lose their lives. So in the book, Anna is a troubled journalist with a crazy life in desperate need of some order, which comes not a minute too soon in the form of Mercy, her African maid. And I would like to introduce Mercy. Mercy had walked up to me one morning in the mini market near my house, a giantess miraculously squeezed into a pink halter top and fake patent leather pants. She had crossed her arms over her enormous breasts and bellowed, "You are now living in that place there, the one with the red gate." I had hesitated. She was a good head taller than me and roughly twice my size. So I cleared my throat and asked, "Have we met before?" "No," was her brusque answer. "But me, I am a house girl, and they have been telling me. They have been saying there's no one there." "Who has been telling you?" "The ones who are staying near there." "Near where?" Mercy took a lengthy inhalation. "Are you the one now who's staying in that house where the ones from Belgium were now staying?" "Yes," I told her, "yes. So I'm saying," and here she paused, took another long, patient breath. "I'm saying I am a house girl." She was at my door at 7 the next morning, a look of intense disapproval in her eyes. "In Africa, we rise with the sun. Now you, what time do you rise?" I followed her meekly around the house, eventually taking refuge in my study. When I came out for a bite of something to eat, the house had been transformed. The floors shone, windows and faucets sparkled. The sofa cushions stood preternaturally alert and symmetrically aligned at both ends of the couch. And every single thing, from bits of paper to stray glasses, had been put in its proper place. "You get me a uniform," she instructed that afternoon, with the apron and the headscarf. My life changed overnight. My clothes, the greater part of which I could never find, were now arranged by color in my closet. My shirts ironed with such precision, I often looked ridiculous. I was pleased, of course, but I could not help wondering what sort of opportunity Mercy had sensed with me, how amicable her intentions truly were. I was alone in a deeply alien city, in a house far too big for my needs. I traveled all the time. I was messy, distracted. I lost things. She became indispensable in no time, but I never knew where I stood with her. She had, and this is what made her such an enigma, been extremely successful in the past. Before her husband put a gun to her head and made away with all her money, Mercy had supplied the majority of Nairobi's slums with muratina. Money can buy few things worse than muratina, and from what I gathered, Mercy wasn't hugely particular about what she put in it. Thinning agents, disinfectant, antifreeze, it made little difference to her. And why should it? She supplied a ragged multitude with the quickest, the most potent medication for its pain. So what if sons killed fathers, husbands axed wives, and people went blind on the moonshine Mercy brewed in industrial vats off River Road? In that first rush of alcohol, in that first blooming of blood, the dead child, the failed scramble for a bag of onions, the sexual favor granted to the unrelenting landlord, the rage, the shame of poverty, were all forgotten. Mercy didn't touch the stuff. She had a business to run. She coordinated a small army of runners and drivers and was so punctual and so reliable in her deliveries that a rumor spread of a personal connection to the president. But Mercy's stories was not one of personal connections and privilege. She had started out as a prostitute in a tiny village near Mount Kenya and moved to Nairobi in her mid-20s, setting up a bar consisting of a table, a bench, and two large plastic tubs hidden in the back of her mud hut. After years of violent wrangling to obtain payment from her drunken customers, after two broken arms, three cracked ribs, and an inch-long scar across one eyebrow, Mercy had turned her intelligence to the more complex world of wholesalers. Success had come instantly. As her business expanded, so had her fame. She became known as the woman from River Road, the largest supplier of Muratina in Kenya. And the next section, which will be the last, takes place in the slum of Gorokocho, which is probably the worst slum in Nairobi. Soon it was dark and Mercy began to fret. She was in the middle of organizing a posse for her passage out of the slum when Father Anselmo walked in, tense, gaunt, withdrawn. He was surprised to see us there, having forgotten all about us. "Can you come back tomorrow?" he asked, disappearing into his bedroom and reappearing with a black knapsack into which he was stuffing a candle. "Where are you going?" I asked. "Masses for the terminally ill." "AIDS? What else?" he snapped. "Can I come with?" "If you wish." But Mercy stood up. "The place is now too dangerous. No one will touch her," Father Anselmo said. And no one did. Three or four times that night, we came across ragged gangs of men with knit caps pulled low over their foreheads, fire in their eyes and stomachs. My hair stood on end as I watched this first six appear, shoulders hunched, fists sunk deep in their pockets. I sensed their intent, rapacious, keen. Father Anselmo, on the other hand, showed no sign of having registered their presence. And I remember thinking in the seconds before our paths crossed that Africa had taught me nothing, that this suicidal running around in the company of a half-starved priest was the precise sum of my mistakes. Then a miracle took place. The man in the lead recognized Father Anselmo, pulled off his hat and let out a raspy greeting. "Abadi ya usiku, Baba. How are you this evening, Father?" The priest didn't even stop. "What are you doing out so late?" he yelled. "Go home, all of you." "Aye, Baba," they murmured in turn. "Tunarudi sasa." "Yes, Father, we're going now." Father Anselmo kept walking. The moon rose over the metal rooftops, casting a harsh light on the strangely deserted alleys, on the grayish ooze festering in puddles and in sluggish streams down the open sewers on both sides. There were no lights, no sounds, except for dry coughing and infant wailing. I was about to switch my torch off when I saw a woman sprawled out on the side of the road, both breasts exposed, one foot turned out at an impossible angle. I grabbed Father Anselmo's arm. "She's dead. She's drunk," he snapped, pulling his arm away. "Let's go." "Shouldn't we? I don't have time." And he moved on. I didn't dare say it, but I wondered what sort of priest could walk past a scene of such human degradation without stopping. The answer became clear to me as the evening wore on, and what I had imagined to be an exception too proved to be the rule. I don't know how many bodies we walked past that night. Prone, supine, male, female, fully clothed, almost entirely naked. But it could not have been less than a dozen, all of them drunk on Muratina. Eventually, we made our first stop, ducking through a low doorway into a frigid room immersed in total darkness. "God be with you," Father Anselmo hollered. "And also with you," came the tremulous reply. A match was struck, a candle lit, and in the dim light I saw a woman struggling to get out of a low, dingy bed as a girl cleared a space on a table barely bigger than a stool. Father Anselmo unzipped his sack. Out came a chalice, a gilded plate, a crucifix, a candle, and a small tin box. Two more women made a timid entrance and lit a candle each. "Good evening, Father," they whispered. But the priest had sunk to his knees and was deep in prayer. By the time he stood up, nearly 10 minutes later, 12 more women, holding a candle each, had somehow managed to squeeze into the room and stood with their heads bowed, their lips moving in silent prayer. Father Anselmo leaned toward the dying woman. "What is your name?" he whispered. "Jessica. Jessica, where does it hurt?" "Here," the woman murmured, touching her head. The priest placed one hand on her forehead, his face filled with pity. Then he began. "We are gathered here today to bring Jessica the love and solace of God our Father. May he give her the peace she so deserves and needs." As if on cue, the woman started singing, and a low melody of almost intolerable sweetness rose to the highest corners of the room. It rose above the dancing flames, into the grooves of the metal roofing, onto the back of the night. More women came. Unable to get in, they crowded the doorway, bringing in more light, more warmth, until the air itself seemed to ignite and subsume the narrow chemistry of death into the broader flow of life. So I just want to explain a bit more about the book. The book essentially tells the relationship between a white journalist and this woman who's initially hired as her maid, but quickly becomes her judge, her most relentless judge, and also her closest friend. I can't tell you what happens. I mean, I'm very, very tempted because the plot revolves around this one turning point, but I'm told that I've been advised not to divulge it. And other than that, I can say that Mercy, who is, in my opinion, the main character in the book, is purely fictional. There are things in this book which undoubtedly took place, and there are characters that have resonance to real people, but Mercy is entirely fictional, and she is, to me, the best thing about this book. And she was initially meant to just be a foil to Anna's, to the journalist's compulsions and addictions. And to my surprise, she ended up sort of claiming more and more space, more and more time, and became the character that she is. And it really was her own doing. And I became so attached to her that as things happened, you know, to her, and I literally weep. I mean, she became a very important person in my life as I was writing the book. And I think, I don't know, where's Matt? Yeah, do people have questions and I want to say something? No, that's interesting. No, I had African women in my life in, you know, in the position of housekeepers. But you'll find as you read, if you do indeed buy the book and read it, that Mercy is, I mean, I hate to say this because the relationship between a white person and an African maid in Africa is pretty set. I mean, they are deferential. They are strong, but they are fundamentally deferential. The protocol for the relationship is set in just the fact that you're white and they're black, and the fact that you're rich and they're poor, the fact that they almost owe their life to you. They need the money. They will not contest you. They will not pass a certain point, whereas Mercy becomes the actual boss in that house. She literally takes over Anna's life. She takes over the house. She takes over her life. And she literally picks her up by the scruff of the neck and teaches her how to be like the big people in this world, because Anna is self-destructing. I mean, spectacularly, sort of explosively self-destructing. And so the tables are turned. It is Mercy who is in charge shortly after she gets in the house. And I think you'd find it difficult, that paradigm, for that paradigm to really exist in a place like Kenya. I think you'd find it difficult. I mean, it may, but I haven't come across it, not in my time there. No, sadly, that's completely fictional. But I mean, it is my fervent hope, you know, that it should come about one day, because the people who are now, you know, the impetus for global access to HIV drugs is essentially being run by whites, and it's being run by whites through white channels. And I mean, we've had these medicines for 15 years now, and the fact that only one out of four, so 25% of those who need them, you know, have them, is an indication to me of failure. I mean, my belief is that it is for the Africans to find a solution, because whatever solution comes from external solution will only be a palliative. As it is, I mean, look, there's no question. When I left Africa, no one had access to antiretroviral therapy. And now one in four people do, but it's a disgrace. I mean, it's been 15 years these drugs have been made. They've been around for 15 years. You know, three-fourths of the continent has no access to these drugs. And the drugs that they have, by the way, are generic drugs. They're not patented drugs. I think for me it was keeping calm, you know, just being able to, what I managed to do is sort of produce a sort of a split reaction. On one side you have Anna's reaction, which is, you know, she's always raging, she was angry, she was screaming, and then you have Mercy's reaction, which is one of cool, control, calm, just being able to deal with it without, you know, losing your temper. I think what I really wanted to focus on, and there are people who will say, this is just only one approach, but my focus from the very beginning was on drugs. And people will tell you today that, you know, you should focus on non-existing, you know, health structures and channels of distribution and this and that. But in my opinion, those things have always been secondary. In the primary problem for me, the fundamental problem is that there are no drugs. And that even if, you know, so for me, while I was writing the book, was how do I, you know, reduce what is actually a multifaceted problem into what I believe to be the most fundamental component. And it was, well, I shouldn't tell you because I give it away, but it was by basically making someone sick and with them having absolutely no access, no recourse to antiretroviral therapy, and to show what that's like, and then to suddenly provide them with access and see the transformation. I mean, that to me remains the... And even now with, you know, this sort of rollout of antiretrovirals, the truth is that for the lucky one in four who was lucky enough to get on it, have developed toxicity or resistance, and they, in order to survive, need second-line drug therapy. And those are just patented and unavailable and completely. So we're back to square one, really back to square one. I don't know. I never thought that I would write a memoir, partly because I was in Africa for 7 years. I didn't have, you know, 20 years in Africa, but it just never occurred to me to write a memoir. I always knew I wanted to write a piece of fiction, partly because of the freedom. I mean, Mercy is completely fictional. Of course, as you pointed out, there are women in Africa that have been inspiration, but, you know, the character herself is fictional. It's tremendous freedom in writing fiction. It definitely was, for sure. It definitely was. Yeah, and it wasn't easy. I mean, it took me about 4.5 years to write, and I had to start over a couple of times. I had to literally just put 200 pages in the bin and then start again, and then I did it again, put another 200 pages in the bin. But the whole process was enormously helpful to me. Yeah. You know, it really goes country by country, and it's related to the donors that are involved in that country and are providing generic drugs, and so the level of generic drugs that are being provided by donors, the level of existing, you know, medical care, health facilities, health staff like nurses, which is severely sort of lacking most everywhere, but it really goes country by country. It also goes by government to government. I mean, Uganda, for instance, has had a spectacularly proactive and has managed to actually reverse the rate of contagion. It is the only country. But it is because years ago, when I first moved there, in the mid-90s, the president actually made it a priority. And they set in place a program. And they actually managed to reverse the rate of infection. Now, next door, Kenya did no such thing. And in some areas, Kenya has one of the highest rates in Africa. I mean, in Nyanza, which is where the Luos live, I mean, there are pockets of 70% infection. So it really depends. It really goes country by country, government by government. It also, in some ways, depends on the donors. Some donors find some countries sexier than others. And because, sadly, the whole effort to provide antiretroviral drugs right now is in the hands of donors. It really has to do with them, and they, you know, some of their concerns are definitely well placed. They look at a government and say, well, I don't really trust you to roll out these drugs in a way that is transparent and acceptable. And other times they'll go to a place because they know they'll get more publicity, or because the NGOs know that they might get more publicity if they're in a place. You know, I don't want to make examples, but so it varies dramatically. It really, really does. Yeah, I think stigma, you know, there's suspicion definitely of outsiders. I think stigma underlies, you know, the fundamental reaction to, you know, somebody going in there and say, well, here we go, we've got all these drugs, so go ahead and start taking them. And, you know, a lot of people will say, who, me? I don't need it, I'm fine. And in terms of distrust of outsiders, yes, I have seen that too, but I've never been involved in the distribution of the actual drug, so I probably haven't seen it. How did you go there? In what capacity did you end up?
I was actually helping with the film.
Oh. I haven't come across it probably as firsthand as you have, but I am aware of it, yes. Yeah, I think you'll find that, I mean, I remember the outcry when, I don't remember whether it was this pope, it must have been the other pope, who came out and said, you know, there may be millions of you dying, but no condoms. And I remember because I was there. And my personal experience, and I don't know whether Matt will agree with me, but I suspect he will, is that while failing to take issue, you know, on the surface, your average missionary, whether Catholic or Christian or whatever, was handing out condoms. I mean, in complete disobedience. I mean, no one can, I don't think, can actually go along with something as ludicrous as that if they've been exposed to that kind of suffering. They just know to just say, fine, you're in Rome, do whatever you have to do, say whatever you have to say, but I will personally hand out condoms. That's my experience of the religious workers I've seen in Africa. And this priest is certainly an example of that. Yes. Yeah. Well, this is the problem, part of the big problem with the money that's coming in is that it has all sorts of strings attached, and that is definitely one of the strings. I don't know if you're referring to the Christian fundamentalists. Are those the groups you're referring to? Yeah. Or the faith-based. Right. Sorry. yeah, I mean... Yeah, and this is part of the, this definitely, of course, yes. And this is why I think that, you know, the way antiretroviral therapy rollout is happening right now is not the solution, because it does come with all these strings attached. Not really. I'm not entirely sure. Some may, you know, but not at a grassroots level. No, I don't believe they do. Yes.
The fact that when Matt introduced you, it sounds like you arrived in search of wars to write about. And correct me if I'm wrong, when did the AIDS war strike you, and how did that strike you?
Well, I went precisely for that, because I'd gotten a taste of war before going to Africa, in Europe, and... That's just what I wanted to do. I wanted to, and I kept going from war to war, and it was in a way the sexy thing, you know, the adrenaline, and Matt can testify to that. But somehow, somewhere, I got a sort of a growing sense of awareness that AIDS was really the biggest story, because it wasn't nearly as sexy, but it was far worse in many, many ways. And so it became increasingly, you know, the one story I wanted to tell. And partly because I realized that we weren't making a dent, that, you know, we were confronted with death on such a scale. I mean, it's very difficult to really wrap your mind around it when you walk into a hospital and literally they're part hospitals, part mortuaries, people lying stacked sideways on a bed, dead and dying. You can't distinguish them. And I started thinking, well, we're not telling this story. We're not telling this story. We really. And so every time I came back to Nairobi, I tried to pitch an AIDS story. And it became something I did more and more with greater and greater frequency, with no visible result. I just didn't see anything really happening. And I just saw people's eyes glazing over as they were hit with yet another story about AIDS. And I think that was partly what happened with this novel, is I thought, you know, if as journalists we're not doing it, we're just not somehow doing it, let's see what happens if you write a novel and you create a character that people actually grow to feel for. But yeah, the AIDS, it was a gradual thing. I would say it took me about a couple of years before I realized what I was dealing with, and then I made it an absolute priority. I'd always come back and try and pitch a story. Or sometimes in a country where I was, I would just take off and do an AIDS story. And the thing is, I mean, I wish Matt could sort of speak about this too. It's just, it's indescribable. I mean, I think the closest we've come, if you look at the numbers, the closest we've come in Europe, I mean, in Western experience, is the Black Death, which wiped out one quarter of Europe's population. And it's very difficult to, if you don't see it, if you're not there, very difficult to understand. I mean, you've got death as a sort of constant companion. If you're not dying, then your husband is. If your husband's not dying, then your children are. If your children are not dying, then your relatives are. If they're not dying, they're in the hospital in the process of dying. Or they've just died and you have to find money to bury them. I mean, it's constant. You do not get away from it, ever. It's difficult for us to imagine. Very, very difficult. Well, you know, some people say there are as many as between 15 million, and some organizations have, you know, 25 million of orphans as a result of AIDS. And a good number of them are the street kids. You know, they feed off the city's waste, different cities' waste, and live absolutely terrible life, and very, very hardened by the time they're eight, you know, sort of. My personal conviction is that for Africa to pull itself out of this and start dealing with is they've got to basically turn around and issue compulsory licenses I'm not addressing the specific problem of the orphans, but I'm just saying above and beyond, if we can make sure that the mothers don't die and, you know, look after their children, and the only way to do that is to actually take patented drugs that exist, and rather than wait for the donors to roll them out from generic competition in places like India or Brazil, to actually have African governments issue compulsory licenses which give them the right to manufacture these drugs locally, to copy the formulas and manufacture them locally at a fraction of the cost. That way you'll find that if, you know, someone's mother's, I mean, an orphan is out on the street, maybe by prolonging his aunt's life, she'll be able to look after him and 10 of his friends. To me, the key for looking after orphans right now is keeping the adults alive, as many of them as possible. Because at the rate they're dying, you know, the number of orphans will grow, and then, you know, of course, because it's that middle bracket. It's the ages from the ages of, you know, 20 to 40. They're disappearing. To keep that middle bracket alive would make a big, big difference. Yes.
When you say donors, who do you
mean? Well, right now the biggest ones are the Global Fund, which was created by George Bush, which pools a great number of donors. So you've got. Well, you've got countries, you've got governments, you've got organizations, you've got corporations. Donors come in many different sizes and shapes and, you know, can really... But basically, they're all either American or European. And, you know, they basically buy generic drugs from Brazil or India and then basically bring them in. And so now the cost of antiretroviral therapy, thanks to generic competition, by the way, not thanks to patent products, but thanks to generic competition, is down to $100-$150 a year. And this is great. This has been accomplished, you know, by the Global Fund for AIDS and by PEPFAR, which is the largest, but hasn't really done what it was supposed to do. It was started on the assumption that there would be global access, free access to HIV drugs. One in four, and it's not free. So it's come very short of its objective. Are you... Okay, one second. They're fairly, they're among the lowest, I think one can... No, I wish I did, but I know, broadly speaking, that they're among the lowest. The Muslim population in Africa is among the lowest. Yeah, sir, because, yeah.
You obviously chose to emphasize that. Is that a major aspect of your experience in Africa vis-a-vis the AIDS crisis?
Yeah.
These kinds of people.
Definitely. Well, I mean, definitely. I would have to make a distinction here, which... In fact, Matt, I'm going to ask you to say whether you agree to this or not, but I'm going to make a distinction at my own risk. I think that women, especially in Africa, have come together to look after each other and to look after each other's children. I think that men have fallen short, have, as a category, not really pulled through. Where you go to any slum, what you'll find at the grassroots in terms of support, whether with children or with food or with going into somebody's frigid room and bringing in light and warmth, it is invariably the woman. It is very rare, in my experience, that group of men have gotten together to provide any sort of comfort to each other or to their wives or to their children. Matt, because you're a guy, I'm going to ask you to comment on that. There is, and maybe it comes from nurturing children, and it comes more naturally to women than to men. It also the role that men have in African society. I mean, they're you know, the macho, the whole thing. And as for the figure of the priest, I have come across the most extraordinary people. Just really, and this, by the way, I mean, the priest is fictional. In the sense that he comes through as a, you know. But when I first went to Kenya, I met an Italian priest who had lived in the slum of Korokocho for 12 years. And he was the one who brought me into the slum for the first time. Sadly, he then left. And he's now in Palermo fighting the mafia. But he was extraordinary. I mean, I never got to know him as a person. So the priest described in this book, who's one of the main characters in the book, is... fictional. But yeah, there are people like that. Extraordinary people from all countries, from all nationalities, from everywhere. Yes.
Back to the drugs. I recently read that other countries could produce the needed drugs.
This is a huge point. I mean, it's in the book. The U.S. Department of Trade imposes, let's put it in very sort of, what the U.S. Department of Trade has done to prevent Africans from gaining access to life-saving drug is disgraceful. They have applied incredible pressure, often very successfully, in fact, almost always, inevitably successfully, on two different fronts. One, the importation, the parallel importation of generic drugs, which countries could do by themselves without having to resort to PEPFAR or the Global Fund or any of that, and the issuance of compulsory licenses. The government, the U.S. government, on behalf of the pharmaceutical industry, goes to a country like Kenya and says, you want to be my partner in trade? You've got to respect intellectual property rights. Number one, you do not import generics. You do not parallel import generics unless they come from my channels and my donors in the way I say it. And number two, you do not even dream of issuing a compulsory license if you want trade and aid. And they've done this across the board, across the board. The only way for Africa to fill its quota and to really provide free global access to antiretroviral therapy is for the governments of Africa to issue compulsory licenses. There is no other way. And they're too scared. They're too scared. It's been made very clear what the consequences are. Thailand has just issued a compulsory license for a heat-stable solution called Kaletra, which all of Africa would need because it is heat-stable. It does not need refrigeration. It's been put on the 301 list of U.S. government, you know, violators of trade rules, whereas the very trade rules that all these countries obey specify that on the grounds of a health emergency, you can do whatever you want. You can issue whatever compulsory license you want. You can parallel import drugs from, you know, from the moon. It is your right. And yet they're under this severe, severe pressure not to do anything about it. Just sit and wait for the donors to go to Brazil, to go to India, gather together, you know, a minimal amount of antiretrovirals, and then hand them out for $100 a patient. This is not the solution. I mean, it hasn't been. Sorry, the lady in the back, yes. Okay. Well, there was a very famous episode years ago where after Nelson Mandela left office, Thabo Mbeki came in, and he was new and supposedly foolish, and he said, what do you, and I think it was also a reaction of the fact that the AIDS crisis was being handled from the outside by white people. All these donors and do-gooders and, you know, nothing was being done from the ground up. And he said, you know, what do you know? How do we know what's the cause of AIDS? We don't really know, which is foolish. I mean, because you certainly knew it was through sexual contagion and it was through this. And he did it more of a sort of polemic. Sadly, it's kind of stuck. And it's taken him years to sort of backtrack. I don't know whether he's done it successfully or even convincingly. It was a foolish thing. Yes.
Having worked in international public health now for 10 years and working on several neglected tropical diseases, I've actually seen what grassroots community efforts can do. And I think in the fight against AIDS, there's compliance issues with antiretrovirals. There are major challenges to overcome. And in trying to overcome those challenges and to get the drugs in the country, you still need the sweeping preventive measures.
I totally agree. Right.
Because she went to an AIDS conference that she wasn't even permission to go to,
I agree. I completely, I could not agree with you more. I mean, the reason why I narrowed my focus is because I felt that it would help, at least in, you know, I just thought if you're going to really start talking about, and also it's an attention span. I mean, you've worked in public health for 10 years, but how many people are really going to sit down and write a book that talks about every single component part of the, you know? So for me, it was a strategic decision. You know, what do I focus on? And I felt at the time that it was access to drugs. But you're right, it's a far more complicated problem than that. I think last question. Do we have? Yes.
Did you find that you needed to find your own light at the end of the tunnel as your character in the journalistic book finds through Mercy? Is there a light, you know, as you're covering these what seems to be almost intractable issues?
So you've read the book? Oh, you haven't? Okay. No, because you said through mercy. So mercy is indeed Anna's salvation. I mean, mercy is, and I didn't have a mercy in my life. I think this is probably a broad statement, but I was very lucky. I had a child, and I was able to, well, I had to because I couldn't keep running around Africa the way I did or the Balkans. And I think it was my child, it was my daughter, who really, she was my light at the end of the tunnel. She really was. I mean, whatever I had to deal with on a psychological level, or, you know, somehow it worked through her. I mean, partly because I had to sublimate a lot of it. But she, you know, she's 6 years old now, so, you know, she tells me what to do. But she really was the turning point. Well, thank you so much for coming. Thank you very, very much.